Okay, welcome everybody. This is the first office hour session for Anatomy of the Fed, the Mises Academy online class. And it is, what is the date today? June 30th, 2012. So let me just explain, well, for one thing, I'm a bit sweaty because it's like 105 degrees here in Nashville in the midst of a heat wave. And prices matter, so I haven't set my thermostat too low. So the way these office hours work, for those of you who are new to my classes on Mises Academy, this is just an open air. You guys just ask me whatever you want, and I answer it for the next hour. So hopefully some of you have something to get the ball rolling. And it can be about anything. Obviously, if you have a question pertaining to the material in the course, ask that first, and I'll try to help you with that. But this is just a free-for-all. And the other thing, just to remind you, is if you're taking this course for credit, it wouldn't hurt you, obviously, to listen to these office hour sessions, either live or after the fact listening to the recordings. But you don't need to, in the sense that anything that I ever test you on in the quizzes or in the final, you would have had access to either in the readings or the Monday main lectures. So this is just supplementary. Okay, so one last thing, and I'll jump into these questions. You don't need to wait for me to wrap up my answer to somebody else's question before you answer or before you ask your question. Okay, so that'll help me pace myself better. So if there's a bunch of you who have a bunch of questions and you're thinking, oh, I got to be polite and wait till answers Mike's question, then I'll post mine. Don't do that, because I'll take a long time answering Mike's question if I look in the window when there's no new questions, because I'll think no one's got any more questions. Okay, so Bevesh, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, says, do you see hyperinflation or very high inflation as imminent in the near future? Well, okay, so that's a good question. So the problem is, I don't see hyperinflation, if by that we mean literally the dollar collapsing. Okay, so even unless, how do I put it, even if you looked at the other, one last, I see someone asking, I can't see other people's questions, maybe because I came in late. What's going on there, guys, is when you type in your question, there should be a box that says send to, and then you want to switch that to all participants. So don't just send it to the, I guess I would be the host maybe. So calibrate when you type in your questions so that all participants can see them, because it's just easier for people. Okay, so as far as the inflation stuff, the term hyperinflation, I mean, if you're talking about interwar Germany or Zimbabwe, I mean, they were having a 1,000,000,000% inflation per year, at least in Zimbabwe. I don't remember how high it was in Germany. But, I mean, it was ridiculous. It wasn't just, oh, my gosh, prices rose 50% or something. I mean, it was literally prices going up by a factor of 1,000 in a short period of time. So as much as Bernanke has done crazy stuff lately, it's nowhere near approaching that, even if he just sat back and let the excess reserves in the banking system get lent out and had the money multiplier and all that stuff. It would maybe raise prices by like a factor of 5 or 8, something like that, the last time I ran the numbers back of the envelope. Now, it's true, the dollar is in a special position because it's the world reserve currency, So it's not merely that, oh, what has Bernanke added if it all leaked out into the system and raised prices, how much would prices go up? That's not the only worry. The other problem is if people around the world who right now are holding dollars because they think the dollar historically has been a relatively safe currency, if they saw that process unfolding, well, they would get out of the dollar. And so then it's not merely how much Bernanke has pumped into the system the last few years. It's also that if the dollar suddenly was no longer the world reserve currency, you would see an influx, effectively, of dollars from people who had been holding them around the world. But again, worst case scenario, okay, prices might go up by a factor of 10 or 15 or something. So don't get me wrong, that's awful. That would be like gasoline at, whatever, $45 a gallon. So that's awful. But my point is that really isn't hyperinflation. And now, what could happen is if we start going down that path and then the U.S. government, you know, wants to spend money and then the interest rates on federal government debt start going way up because people are building in price inflationary expectations and stuff like that, and then the government just turns more and more to Bernanke saying, hey, you got to get us out of this jam. And then he just starts running the printing press even more, trying to keep one step ahead of the rising prices. Well, then, yeah, you get hyperinflation. And that's what happens historically, is that once that genie gets out of the bottle, the governments with access to the printing press don't just stop and just let the thing run its course and have their, you know, have the government's finances get destroyed. They think, well, nuts to that. We're not constrained. We can keep, in real terms, we can keep spending more and more because we'll just print faster than prices are rising. And then that's what sets up the hyperinflationary dynamic. So don't misunderstand. I'm not saying it's impossible that we would have true hyperinflation in the next 18 months. It could happen. It's just it would take a lot more than what Bernanke has already done. But don't get me wrong. He's set us up so that it's not inconceivable it could happen. Now, having said all that, I'm a little bit gun-shy about throwing off predictions at this point because I thought regular price inflation would be higher by now than it has been. And it's true, the government has all kinds of tricks it uses, the Bureau of Labor and Statistics, to suppress what the official numbers are, I think. But I knew that when I was throwing out my predictions. I thought even with the government's attempts at downplaying how much prices are rising, they can't hide the fact that food costs more, and electricity costs more, and the gasoline's going to cost more, right? And so that really has not happened as much as I thought it was going to. So the issue is just, well, is it because all those excess reserves are in the system and investors are stupid and that they just don't see things the way I do, and in 5 years everyone's going to say, oh my gosh, those people like Murphy and Peter Schiff were right? Or is it just that we're totally wrong? And obviously I'm biased and I think that it's because we're right and it's just taken longer for the rest of the world to realize it, but of course I would think that. This is what the world would look like if I were totally wrong. So there you go. Jay Leffingwell says, could you go over the marginal utility of money and Mises' regression theorem? Yeah, sure, that's a good one. Okay, by the way, for people who are trickling in late here, make sure when you – so type your questions right into the chat box. You don't wait for me to finish a question because I need to pace myself. And then when you send the question out, make sure your box there is selected to all participants so everyone can see it. Okay, so the marginal utility of money – so the deal there is what Mises did – okay, let me back up. So Karl Menger was one of the pioneers in the subjectivist marginalist revolution. And so what he did is he showed how you could explain market prices not by reference to the long-run costs of making particular items. So the classical economists, if they wanted to explain, gee, why is a stagecoach have 10 times the market value as that pig, they might say something like, well, because in the long run it takes 10 times as much resources to make the stagecoach than it does to raise an adult pig and bring it to market. And so that's why, if you think about competition and stuff like that, it has to be the case that in long run equilibrium the market value of a stagecoach is 10 times the market value of an adult pig. And that's actually, there's nothing wrong with that explanation insofar as it goes. But there's a lot of shortcomings. If for those of you who are really interested in this, what you should do, oh man, I'm trying to think. It's my I think it's called the labor theory of value. I'll type it out. The labor theory of value, a critique of, what is that guy's name? Kevin Carson. Okay, so it's, that's a an article I wrote for the Journal of Libertarian Studies. I might have the wording a little bit off, but if you Google that, you know, say Robert Murphy JLS or something like that, I think you'll be able to find it. So there I go through pretty carefully and say what the classical labor theory of value was and then what the modern subjectivist margin utility approach is and why I think the latter is just hands down a scientific advance. It's just a more general explanation. So the classical labor theory could only explain long-run equilibrium prices. They couldn't explain the day-to-day fluctuations in the spot price based on changing what we would call supply and demand, and whereas the Mengerian explanation could. Okay, so the problem, though, so what did Menger do in a nutshell? Well, he said, first of all, the reason the stagecoach is 10 times the market price than the adult pig is that the consumers in the marketplace who are buying these things, that's just the way their margin and utilities play out. And so that's the first step. So when you're trying to understand why is something valued in the marketplace, well, it's because the people buying it get subjective utility from it, from that marginal unit. And that's the first step in the explanation. Then you can build up everything from there. All right, so Menger went from the consumers or the customers and then worked backwards up to the factors of production. All right, so the problem then is, so that was great. Everyone likes that. All the economists were won over by this new approach. But where they hesitated to apply this new technique was explaining the market value of money. All right, so why was it that 1 ounce of gold traded for 2 adult pigs or whatever? And there it seemed a bit artificial or contrived to use this new marginal subjectivist utility approach, because what you would say is, oh, well, the reason the guy who has 2 pigs would give them up to obtain 1 ounce of gold, like a coin that was 1 ounce of gold, is because he got more, the margin utility he got from the gold coin was higher than his margin utility from those 2 pigs. So he benefited from the trade subjectively, and, you know, the opposite for the guy who was buying the pigs. He got more utility from the 2 pigs than from the gold coin he was giving up. Maybe he had 15 gold coins, and so that 15th coin on the margin didn't have much utility for him, and so that's why he increased his utility by giving that up and getting the 2 pigs. So that's fine insofar as it goes, and that's actually correct. That's the way I would start the explanation. But the economists, say in the late 1800s, early 1900s, they were saying, wait a minute, that's a vacuous explanation, because it makes sense to me to say the stagecoach trades for 10 pigs because people get more utility from the stagecoach than the pigs, loosely speaking. Right? That makes sense, because I understand why people would get utility from having a stagecoach. It performs useful services for you, blah, blah, blah. I understand why people would value getting an adult pig, because you can kill it and get bacon or whatever. And okay, fine. But when you say the pig farmer gets utility from the 1 gold coin, and that's why he'd give up his pigs for it, it seems like you're just moving in a circle, because when you say, okay, but why? Is he going to eat the gold coin? Is he going to just look at it because it's pretty? And you say, no, the reason he gets utility from it is because he expects that down the road, when he wants to buy something else, he can take that gold coin to market and trade it away and get something else for it. And so really what he's doing is he's giving away his 2 adult pigs for the expectation of being able to obtain something that 1 gold coin has the purchasing power to get for you in the future. And that's really what he's trading off in his mind. So the problem then is, people were saying, so what we're trying to do is explain why is it that the gold coin has that purchasing power. We're trying to explain why, if you have a gold coin, can you go up to a pig farmer and get two adult pigs for it, which are, you know, valuable. Why does this little piece of metal, yellow metal, have this power in the marketplace? And so it seemed odd to just say, oh, it's because the farmer values it, since the reason he values it is it has power in the marketplace. So basically what we're saying is the reason you can go around and buy lots of stuff with gold coins is that you can go around and buy lots of stuff with gold coins. So see how it looks like you're arguing in a big circle. So a lot of economists hesitated and thought this subjective marginalist approach to explaining market prices works if we're dealing with a barter economy. But then if we want to explain a monetary economy, we need a different approach, maybe something like, to say, MV equals PQ, and we'll look at the whole stock of money in the economy and look at all the total output and divide it or something like that, or look at the velocity of turnover. So they're using a macro, non-individualistic approach to explain, non-marginal approach to explaining the absolute money prices, whereas to explain relative exchange ratios, they would use this individualistic marginal utility approach. So what Mises did is he coherently and consistently applied the subjective individualist marginal utility approach to explain even absolute money prices. And the way he did it is he said, look, so everything in that explanation is right that we talked about. Yes, the reason the one gold coin gets the two adult pigs is because the pig farmer gets more utility from one more gold coin on the margin than he did from giving up those last two marginal adult pigs. That's why he does it. And so right there we've explained the purchasing power of the gold coin, that yet in the marketplace right now, one gold coin will fetch you two adult pigs. Now when you say, but why did that pig farmer have that expectation? Why did he think the gold coin would be able to fetch him lots of goodies tomorrow so that he would be willing to give up his two pigs today for that hope of getting those other things tomorrow with the gold coin? Well, that didn't just come up out of the air. That pig farmer got those expectations from his observations, let's say, yesterday. When he was out in the marketplace, he looked around and he saw that people who had gold coins were able to get lots of cool stuff for them. And so that grounded his expectations of what the purchasing power of gold was in his economy. And that's why when someone came along and offered him one gold coin for his two adult pigs, he agreed to it. So notice, we haven't argued in a circle. I'm explaining the purchasing power of gold today. I'm explaining why one gold coin today gets you two adult pigs, ultimately by reference to the purchasing power of gold yesterday. That the reason the pig farmer today gives up the pigs for one gold coin is because yesterday he saw the purchasing power of gold. Okay, so it's not a circle. I'm not explaining the purchasing power of gold by reference to the purchasing power of gold, which is what the critics thought, because that would be circular. Rather, what we're doing is we're explaining the purchasing power of gold today by its expectations of purchasing power tomorrow, which in turn are based on our observations of its purchasing power yesterday. So those are three different things. It's not a circle. Okay, now the critic comes back and says, okay, fine, Mises, you're not moving in a circle, but now it's an infinite regress. Right? You're basically explaining gold's purchasing power today by reference to its purchasing power yesterday. But then if I push back the explanation one step and say, okay, Mises, how come gold had such purchasing power yesterday? You're going to tell me, oh, because 2 days ago people saw its purchasing power and that led to their expectations, blah, blah, blah. So you're just going to move backwards in time forever, so that's silly. That's the critic would say. And then Mises says, no, you're right, I move back in time, but not forever. It's not an infinite regress. There's a logical stopping point, namely, we push the explanation back to the point at which gold is just a commodity like anything else, and we're back in barter, or direct exchange, to be more accurate. And at that point, gold is valued just because of its ornamental uses, or if people at that point knew it could be used for industrial purposes, I mean, it probably wouldn't if we're back in barter. All right, but for whatever reason, people good value gold for its own sake, not because it was a medium of exchange back in some distant point in the past. And so we can logically build up an explanation that doesn't rely on a circular argument and doesn't rely on an infinite regress. And that's how we can explain why gold today has its purchasing power as money. Right? So that's the relationship of how Mises took the subjectivist marginal's value theory and used it to explain money prices, and then he had to rely on Menger's theory of the origin of money in order to fend off the critics who were saying, you've just given us an argument that relies on infinite regress. So I don't think Mises called it the regression theorem. I think people afterwards called it that. And what people mean by that is to say that money today ultimately can be traced back to commodities that were not money in the past. So even fiat money today, to explain its purchasing power, you can trace back historically to the point at which it was backed up by gold and silver or something else. And then we can trace gold and silver back. So that's the idea. That's what people mean today by talking about Mises' regression theorem. Okay, George says, does Guido Holzmann's claim in The Ethics of Money Production that there is, in a way, an incentive for fractional reserve banks to cartelize possibly conflict with the claim that a free market and fractional reserve banking limits the bank's inflationary tendencies? Because on the one hand, there is the argument that fractional reserve banking would naturally limit itself in the market, but on the other hand, Holzmann's claim seems to suggest otherwise. Okay, I certainly haven't read The Ethics of Money Production cover to cover, so I don't, off the top of my head, know exactly what Holzmann's claims were that you're talking about. So let me just lay out the way I'm seeing it. So the issue is, what if fractional reserve, what if we have a society that's a total market economy, but the legal system has no problem with fractional reserve banking? So Murray Rothbard and I think Guido Holzmann and probably Walter Block and Hans Hoppe would disagree with that. They would say, no, if it's a true free market that applies libertarian law and property titles, then they should recognize that fractional reserve banking is fraudulent. But suppose that's not how it works. Suppose the legal system has no problem with fractional reserve banking per se, but it does say if the banks issue claim tickets, so let's say gold is the money in this economy, and so there are banks, and because fractional reserve banking per se is not illegal, what can happen is you can go to the bank, give them 1,000 ounces of gold, and they put that on deposit and say, okay, you've got a checking account now of 1,000 ounces of gold, and here we're going to give you, actually you don't want a checking account, you say, you know what, just give me claim tickets. And so they give you 1,000 pieces of paper that look like currency to us, you know, they're bank notes, and each note has printed on it, let's say you took it to Acme Bank, says the bearer of this note can go to any branch of Acme Bank and present it and be given 1 ounce of gold upon demand, assuming, you know, normal business hours and stuff like that. And then you said, now you got 1,000 of those things. So why would you do that? Well, because it's easier for you to carry around 1,000 pieces of paper than 1,000 ounces of gold, for one thing. So that's one reason you might do it. All right. So, and also too, you could get higher denominations. You actually wouldn't need 1,000 pieces of paper. You might say, here's 100 of these. Give me one note that says the bearer gets 100 ounces of gold. And so then if you're going and making big purchases, it's easier to hand someone 100 ounce gold note issued by the very reputable Acme Bank than it is to pull out 1,000 ounces or 100 ounces of gold. Okay? And also, if you're walking around with that much gold on you, you might be a target for muggers, whereas you just have notes in your wallet and people won't know how much you're carrying. Okay, so that's what Acme does. But Acme practices fractional reserve banking. So they don't just take the 1,000 ounces of metal that you gave them and stick it in the vault and then give you the equivalent 1,000 notes and then just say, okay, what they do is after you leave, they say, okay, those notes are going to circulate in the community. At any given time, somebody is going to be holding a lot of those things in his wallet, or if it's a woman in her purse or whatever, they're going to go put it underneath their mattress. So we can get away with using some of this metal that's in the vault, and we're not going to get caught. Because, in other words, the only way we would be in trouble is if all 1,000 of those notes got presented simultaneously, and then we better have all 1,000 ounces in our vault, or else we'd be in trouble. But statistically, that's not going to happen. We, you know, from experience, we know that's not going to happen. People like holding our notes rather than carrying around the clunky metal. And so, you know, we're providing a service to them, and so we should profit from that. How are we going to profit? We're not going to charge them for that conversion. What we'll do is we'll lend out, whatever, 20%. So of the 1,000 ounces he gave us, we're going to keep 800 in reserve just because people might show up and want to redeem it. We don't ever want to be caught not being able to redeem it because our reputation is destroyed. And then no one would trust those notes anymore. But we certainly have a margin to play with, and so let's lend out that gold. Or another way would be we can print up extra notes. So we can print up another 200 ounces gold notes saying the bearer of this can turn it into any Acme branch and get 1 ounce of gold, and we can go lend it to somebody. So somebody comes in and says, hey, I'm a small business person. Here's my plan, blah, blah, blah. I need 200 ounces of gold loan from you because I want to expand my operations, and I'll pay you 8% interest, and I'll pay you back next year. How's that? And if you think it looks like a sound business plan, say, okay. And so now, because Acme's built up this reputation in the community where people treat its notes as good as gold, they actually don't need somebody else's savings to then just channel to lend to this guy. So they don't even need to be a credit intermediary. They can just literally print the notes up out of thin air. And so that's what they do. So the point is, as long as they're careful, they can get away with doing that. But what happens if what happens is in a market where there's lots of banks operating like that, there's this interesting check on their activity. Check meaning like checks and balances, not like a check drawn on a bank. That comes about, so it, and it doesn't even have to be that people, that normal people go to Acme and present the notes. So what's interesting is a free market in banking, there are constraints on the bank's ability to inflate the money supply just because of competition. So what ends up happening is in this community where there's all these merchants and customers buying and selling, not everyone is a customer of Acme Bank because there's other banks where people do their business. So let's say that small business owner comes up and he gets the 200 notes from Acme that Acme just prints up out of thin air. Right, there's no extra gold in the vault backing those up. And then he goes out and he buys office furniture. He buys some computers. He pays some carpenters to come in and put a new room off of his office where clients can come and sit and whatever. All right, so he spends the 200 ounces of gold in the community. And if he spends it on someone who that person, him or herself, is a member of Acme Bank, well, then that's fine. Because they would just take those notes and put them in their wallet and just treat it like anything else probably. Or they might just go to Acme Bank and say, here, and put this in my checking account, and then Acme's fine. Acme doesn't need to give them gold. They can just take that note, destroy it, and then, you know, on the person's checking balance, just add a one to how many ounces of gold they have. So from Acme's point of view, it's just they've transferred from one of their customers to another one this ledger entry. So that's fine. But where the problem is, or where the problem comes in, is when that small business owner who got the 200 notes from Acme, if he spends it buying stuff from people who are not customers of Acme, because then what do? So people don't want to have in their wallet notes issued by all kinds of different banks, especially if you're a business. You're not going to want to have that in your register. You're not going to want to have notes issued by their, so probably what you'll do at the end of the week or end of the month, if you're a business, you'll take all your deposits and you'll go and deposit them at your own bank. So maybe your bank is the XYZ bank. And so now XYZ bank can credit those at par. Because you can say, hey, this was from Acme, Acme's good for it, and XYZ bank can say, yep, you're right, we trust Acme. And so they'll take those notes and then credit your business checking account. You know, if you're the carpenter or something that did work for that small business owner. But now the point is XYZ bank over time is accumulating all these notes that were issued by Acme. And at the same time, the opposite happened. There are customers of XYZ bank that are out in the community buying stuff from customers who happen to be, or from merchants who happen to be customers of Acme. And so Acme is also over time building up a collection of notes issued by XYZ, and the notes say the bearer of this piece of paper can go to any XYZ branch and get 1 ounce of gold. Okay? So then over time what happens is Acme and XYZ settle up. At the end of a week or a month or whatever, they get in contact with each other and say, okay, Acme says, I'm sitting on claims from you saying I'm entitled to whatever, 1,000 pounds of gold, and XYZ says, oh, okay, because I'm sitting on claims from you entitling me to 1,200 pounds of gold. And so then they settle up, they extinguish those notes, and Acme has to physically send 200 pounds of metal, you know, under armed guard over to XYZ, and then they put it in their vault. All right, so the point is, in a competitive free banking system, even if fractional reserve banking is legal, if one bank starts inflating more quickly than the others, by which we would mean if its reserve ratio is lower, so if the amount of gold in the vault backing up their outstanding notes or checking account deposits, if their ratio is lower than the other banks, then that just means statistically over time, probably the other banks, just from the normal interactions of people in the community, the other banks are going to start accumulating more notes, drawn, you know, claiming gold from the expanding bank than vice versa. And so over time, those banks are going to be the ones presenting for redemption, and the reserves in the vault of the inflating bank are going to get siphoned away into the vaults of their competitors. And then after a while, somebody is going to present a note, probably another bank, not just some Joe Schmo, and XYZ is going to, or Acme is going to say, oops, we ran out of gold. We don't have any more in the vault, sorry. And then the community is going to be horrified and say, whoa, nobody ever is going to accept a note from Acme anymore because these things aren't good as gold. The reason we were using these things as money substitutes was that in our experience, you could always take one of these notes and turn it in and get your gold coin because Acme had always been reliable. Now Acme is no longer reliable, and so the word goes out, don't accept their notes at par. And then, you know, Acme would probably go out of business. So that's the mechanism. So now, and this is maybe what Guido was talking about, what I've just shown you is that if we had a free banking system and one bank starts inflating faster than the other banks, there's this mechanism by which that bank would get penalized and probably go out of business pretty quickly. But I haven't thus proven that all the banks, therefore, would keep the reserve ratio close to 100% because they could all have a big meeting and say, okay, guys, we all know if, you know, some of us have 95% reserves, and then you only have 90% reserves, that over time we're going to get all the gold from you and you're going to go out of business. But what if we all collectively agree we're going to only have 90% reserves? Then we all inflate simultaneously, and on average, you know, the claims that our customers present from the other banks all cancel out, and our gold reserves won't be drained from any one of us. And then we can all inflate more, and we can all benefit from printing up more money out of thin air and lending it out to people and earning interest on money that we just created out of thin air. Because that's, in case it's not clear, that's the benefit of inflating if you're the bank. You get to earn more interest on money that you just created out of thin air. So that's a neat little trick. So you want to be able to inflate. It's just if you're too reckless about it, you can run out of gold and be caught with your pants down if too many people turn in those tickets. So the banks would have that incentive. But what the problem, though, is if it really is a free and open market, if they push that ratio down too much, let's say they say, okay, let's push it all down to 50%. Let's push the reserve ratio to 40%. But at some point, there's a wide open gaping profit opportunity for someone else to start up a new bank and to have a reserve ratio higher than what all the banks in the cartel have established. And then that bank, you know, at first, because it's a brand new bank, it would have a small clientele, so it might take a while. But over time, its customers would be depositing more slips drawn on other banks than vice versa, because this bank was being more cautious. And so over time, it would start siphoning off the reserves from all the big cartel banks. And eventually, they would have to reverse course. Okay, so that's the argument. And so that it's an empirical question. So it's not that market forces would push all the banks to have 100% reserves, but the point is if they collectively, market forces would make sure that they all had to have a similar amount of reserves, otherwise one of them would get knocked off pretty quickly. But if they had a cartel and all agreed to inflate simultaneously, at some point, the more they pushed it, there would be a bigger and bigger profit opportunity for someone to come in and start a new bank. And so if that's the way you understand it, now you can see Rothbard's point about why a central bank is so insidious. The function of a central bank and then all the other regulations on the banking sector is to prevent that healthy check. The central bank is there as a lender of last resort, so if any one bank inflates too much and gets caught, it's not out of business, it just goes to the central bank, and the central bank comes in and bails it out. And so that check is gone, and then it also is a cartelization scheme, and you can't just open up a bank that has a higher reserve ratio than all the banks right now, because there's all these regulations on opening up a new bank, so it's not a free market. So Rothbard says that in practice, central banking and all the other regulations the government puts on the banking sector, far from protecting consumers from wildcat inflationary banks, it's the exact opposite. It defangs the inbuilt market processes that would normally protect people from runaway inflationary banks. Okay, Edward Mosley says, speaking of inflation, it is generally recognized that inflation is a function of the loans made by banks, which is why the Fed controls the reserve requirements of banks. But what tools does the Fed have to initiate deflation if it chose to do so? Well, we're going to go over this a lot in a lot more detail in the coming weeks, so I'll just very quickly say it would just do the opposite. So if you understand how it is that the Fed can promote inflation, if the Fed reversed all those things, then it would promote deflation. So if the Fed started selling off assets on its balance sheet, that would destroy reserves in the system, and then that would constrain the, you know, banks would have to start calling in loans because they would now not have enough reserves to meet their reserve requirements because the Fed would be destroying reserves out of the whole system. Or the Fed could raise reserve requirements. Or the Fed could, what's the other thing they can do? I'm drawing a blank as to what the other thing is that the Fed does. But the point is they could, all the ways that the Fed can promote inflation, if they did the opposite, they would be promoting deflation. Well, like I say, we'll go over that stuff a lot more carefully in the coming weeks. Okay. David Bauer says, you mentioned Walras and Jevons as co-creators of subjective value theory along with Menger. Are Jevons and Walras Austrian economists, and what qualifies an economist as an Austrian? Okay, no, they're by no means are they Austrian economists. And so what they did is they, in their own different ways, they approached the problem of how to explain market prices not from the cost or labor input approach like the classicals had done, but starting with the consumer and looking at what we would today call marginal utility. So that's what they did, but they're not Austrians, neither by ethnicity nor school of thought. So Walrath actually was a very mathematical economist. So you could have like a Walrasian economy, which means it's a very mathematical approach, and you find equilibrium through a bunch of conditions that must be true mathematically for the consumers to be optimizing and blah, blah, blah. So that's certainly not what we would think of as an Austrian approach to economics. Jevons, I haven't read enough of him to really speak about his overall place in the history of economic thought, but I don't think anybody ever said that he was even like a fellow traveler of the Austrians. And then David says, so was Schumpeter an Austrian? What makes one an Austrian? Okay, so Joseph Schumpeter, I think most modern Austrians would say he wasn't explicitly what we would call part of the Austrian school, but he was very sympathetic to it and was a fellow traveler. So when you say what makes somebody an Austrian, I don't have a list of necessary and sufficient conditions. I guess, certainly subjective value is important. Focusing on processes and rather than equilibrium states would be a big deal. So the Austrians tend to focus more on how do entrepreneurs get rid of discrepancies in between prices of inputs and the outputs, and how do they ensure equilibrium across various sectors? In other words, the Austrians tend to focus on, given that the market in the real world is never totally in perfect equilibrium, how does the market move towards that equilibrium? Studying those processes really is what the market does and shows us the importance of entrepreneurship, and it also shows why things get screwed up if the government comes in and starts slapping down regulations. Whereas mainstream mathematical economists, what they typically do is they just start thinking, okay, if we're in equilibrium, what conditions would be true? And then they start specifying them mathematically and then solve those list of equations and then say, oh, this is the equilibrium. But they really don't know how the market got to that equilibrium, and it can just lead to perverse things where you can be hostile to the competitive process because in practice, you're never at the snapshot of perfect equilibrium or perfect competition. All right. I guess also, David, after the socialist calculation debate, that really separated the Austrians from other schools of thought. Mises actually has a remark somewhere, I forget where I think he basically said, he himself didn't realize the gulf between his own views and those of his fellow economists until the socialist calculation debate. That before then, he thought, yeah, we all basically are on the same page, modern economists, meaning economists in the 1920s. And then he was very surprised during what we now refer to as the socialist calculation debate to see how differently other economists thought about the economy compared to him, and so that difference is kind of like what I just talked about, that these other economists were saying, no, the socialist central planner could just give it orders to all the factory managers to set marginal cost equal to marginal benefit and blah blah blah, and just go through and basically implement the competitive equilibrium outcome in a mathematical model of the economy. And Mises was just flabbergasted that they actually thought that would work, because he was trying to go through and show they wouldn't have, you need market prices to be able to coordinate those activities, blah, blah, blah. So I'm not really giving you a great answer as to what makes someone an Austrian, because if that's, people ask me that a lot. I can't give you a pithy answer. Okay, Dennis Foster says, so just so you guys know, we got about 12 minutes left by my clock. Dennis Foster says, is the historical origin of money outlined by Menger and Mises seriously contested by other mainstream economists? How? What are the consequences of this? Well, that's a good question. I don't know as far as other mainstream economists, Dennis, but for sure there are other social scientists who can't stand it. And so the obvious example is this guy David Graeber. I'll type his name in this book that he recently had come out called, I think it's called History of Debt or something like that. It's like a 5,000 year history of debt. That might not be the title, but I think it's got debt in the title. And if you're interested, if you want to Google, I did a review of that book for the American Conservative. I also did a real quick thing on the Mises blog, but I did a more formal review of the book in the American Conservative. So I think if you Googled Robert Murphy review David Graeber American Conservative, you'd probably get it. So he relies on anthropological studies and stuff like that, and says these economists are crazy, that this is just a myth that they, and Graeber is a socialist, or I should say a Marxist. I don't know if he calls himself a socialist, but I'm pretty sure he's a Marxist. And so he's also an anarchist, by the way, so he's kind of an interesting guy. But in his mind, the reason we economists perpetuate this myth is it somehow validates the capitalist power structure and it's convenient for us, blah, blah, blah. All right, so he is right that it's not like Menger went out and did a bunch of archaeological digs and then said, oh, look at this. I see here that first there was direct exchange and then these goods were more marketable and then therefore, and then you had money. And I can see that somebody wrote that down in papyrus manuscripts. That's not what happened. Menger basically in his armchair sat back and just thought it through and said it must have been like this. So Graeber is right in that respect, that the economists are kind of being lazy and we're constantly teaching people this is how something happened historically when we really didn't look. So that's true. Having said all that, though, I have looked at the evidence Graeber has presented in his book, and I think it's totally consistent with Menger's story. And it's not worth getting into with 10 minutes left, but like I say, if you're interested in that, you can go look. The punchline is that Graeber was saying that, for one thing, he was saying, why does there need to be a single explanation? Maybe money arose differently among different people throughout history. So that's one thing. And he also said he focused on the ancient Sumerians, and he was saying part of the problem is he's a real cutesy writer, and you don't know what his position is because he'll spend time building up one position. You think that's stupid, and then 2 pages later he'll say, now what I just said for the last 10 pages is stupid because of X, Y, Z. So you realize, oh, he was just like presenting this one train of thought that some people believe, but Graeber wasn't endorsing it. So it's hard to even know what his view is except to say the real world is so much more complicated than these crazy economists would have you believe. I mean, for sure that's what he's saying, but beyond that, it's hard to pin down what his own theory is or his own explanation. But in any event, in one part, he's pointing to this and he's saying, oh, these temple authorities, they were like religious political leaders, and they were paying people in the silver shekel for religious ceremonies and stuff like that. And he thought that was sort of like a bookkeeping entry that these authorities just imposed by fiat on the people. And then also he acknowledged that the merchants nearby happened to be using silver in their transactions too. And so like I said, he doesn't come out and say it explicitly, but you get the sense that he's saying the reason those people use silver is that the religious authorities just out of thin air picked silver as the thing they were going to use for their internal bookkeeping operations, And then it just caught on. And so then the merchants started using it because the people in the temple were getting paid in silver. And so I said, what are the chances of that? Imagine that. Menger's explanation can explain why merchants would be using silver, and then presumably why the temple authorities would bootstrap on that or piggyback on that. If it were the other way around, if it were that, no, these authorities just picked it for whatever reason, why would they pick silver? Isn't that a shocking coincidence, I was arguing in my review, that the commodity that we can totally easily explain from Menger's theory as to why that would be the one people would choose as a medium of exchange, if you're just saying they picked it by fiat, why should there even be a commodity at all? Why don't they just have fiat bookkeeping entries? Why don't they just pay people in pieces of paper that have a stamp on it, you know, that modern governments use? And so it just, and then if it were a commodity, why isn't it some other commodity? Why is it, isn't that just a shocking coincidence that the commodity Graeber is saying emerged through this political authoritarian process and not from the spontaneous market process that Menger talked about? Isn't it an amazing coincidence that they happen to pick silver as their commodity? And, you know, Graeber was aware of my responses and just, I mean, the guy was thoroughly unpleasant. You should just go see the way he handled himself online. But in any event, he wasn't persuaded by my argument, put it that way. Okay, let's see, we got about 6 minutes left. But just to wrap it up, Dennis, I don't know what other economists think. I believe, like, if you look in the Encyclopedia of Economics and look at the origin of money, at one point, Menger was the guy who wrote that entry. All right, so he, and I don't know, I mean, to be honest with you, I bet most economists now have no idea about the origin of money. So it's not that they disagree with Menger, I think they don't even, never even occur to them. But I think the ones that are familiar with the theories and the history and that kind of stuff, I think Menger's explanation was the standard. Okay, Sue Brown says, does or when did our banking system have the limits on credit expansion that Rothbard wrote about, the threat of bank run and the limited clientele of each bank? Well, it was never perfect, but in U.S. history, it was closer to that outcome. I mean, in other words, with the banks of the United States, you know, the first bank of the United States and the second bank of the United States that Andrew Jackson famously killed, and then the Federal Reserve, I mean, in between those periods, you had a much freer banking system than with all those huge cartelization schemes. And, of course, the Fed was more powerful than its earlier predecessors had been. So you always had government intervention giving favors to the bigger banks and allowing them to suspend their contractual obligations and stuff like that. But you did have, at various stretches in American history, something much closer to a true free market in banking. I'm not actually great on colonial history and that kind of stuff to be able to tell you specifically, but we can say it in a negative sense that if the Fed came in and then imposed all kinds of new moral hazard and checks on the market's ability to stop this stuff, then before the Fed it was better. Some people are just making comments, which are good, but they're not really questions. Okay, and we got 3 minutes left, so let's just deal with this last one. So Edward Mosley says, if you have any time left, do mainstream economists agree that the inflationary process is one which involves newly created money, which, by virtue of its new introduction into the economy, is more valuable than the money that has already reached its equilibrium low point? Can you rephrase that? I'm not even sure what you mean by that. Because you're saying, do mainstream economists agree? And I'm saying, I don't agree with that if I understand what you're saying. So new money brought into the economy has a lower value. I mean, it lowers the value of all the money. So why would it be more valuable? I don't know what you mean. Like if a bank creates $100 in new money, that's not, what do you mean that that's more valuable than the $100 bill that's in my wallet? Somebody, a merchant's not going to distinguish between the two. Do you mean that? Okay. So Edward says, why not inflate by giving everyone in the economy $10,000 in their bank account? Do you mean why? Okay, I think I know what you mean. So are you saying the people, when there's inflation, the people who get the money first benefit relative to everybody else? Okay. All right, I mean, which is a pedantic point, but so the issue there, it's not if a bank creates $1,000 in new money by making a new loan out of thin air, it's not that $1,000 is more valuable than the $1,000 somebody else has in his wallet. But what happens is when that new person gets $1,000, prices in general haven't responded yet. And so now that person is at an advantage. It's not because he's at an advantage that his $1,000 is more valuable than somebody else's $1,000. It's that he just got handed $1,000, or he got a loan of $1,000, right? So that's where his advantage comes in, is that this new money is getting dumped into the economy, but it's not that everyone gets it all in a uniform distribution. It's that it comes in through specific entry points, and so those people who get their hands on it first are better off. But again, it's not because any one of those pieces of money is more valuable than any other piece. It's just that you're getting tons of new money dumped on you, so you're better off because of the total amount. Okay, so we'll talk more about that as the course goes on, but Edward is asking, do other mainstream economists get that? And I would say definitively no. They absolutely do not get that point. And so that's, in fact, why you see these silly things, people making fun of Ron Paul and saying, Ron Paul is focusing on how the dollar's lost 95% of its purchasing power since 1913, but that's very misleading. And Ron Paul should be ashamed of himself for speaking such economic nonsense, because wages have risen by such and such percent since 1913 also. And so to figure out if people are getting ripped off, what you need to do is see, did wages rise more slowly than the average price level? And only then could we conclude that workers are being hurt. And that's crazy. Because by that same logic, look, if you double the money supply overnight, you say right now there's whatever, $10 trillion, and then they print up another $10 trillion and give it to me and my brother, and then we start going out and spending, blah, blah, blah. Eventually, all the prices are going to adjust. In an hour of labor, a carpenter or something, or a dentist, an hour of his labor probably is going to be double, or whatever the total ratio is, 5 years from now compared to today. But it would be silly to conclude that therefore my brother and I didn't benefit from being given $10 trillion overnight. Of course we benefited. We would end up owning most of the stuff. It is true, on the margin, so long as that printing of money didn't change the physical productivities, a dentist is still going to get for 1 hour of his labor the same amount in real terms as he did before. But guess what? Everything that all of his wealth that he owned just got cut in half. Because it has to be the case, right? It can't be that my brother and I are fantastically wealthy now because we just got $10 trillion and everybody else is just the same. Because if that were true, then, like you said, why would we just print up money and give it to everybody? If my brother and I are better off because we just got handed $10 trillion, it has to be that other people are worse off, unless you think just printing up trillions of dollars and handing it out makes the economy more physically productive, which most people don't think. Okay, I got to stop there. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Remember, if you're taking the course for credit, you have 2 weeks to do the quiz for week one, so make sure you do that. All right, I'll see you guys on Monday.